The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Preparing the Ruins, the 2015 Annual Conference Recordings, copyright 2015. If you have purchased this recording, you may make additional copies for use by your school. You may not sell copies of the recording, nor post it on the Internet. Learn more about classical Christian education and ACCS at www.accsedu.org.
I'm glad you're here, and this is an awesome time to be thinking about rhetoric in the ruins. Rhetoric in ruins? As in ruined rhetoric? Which I think I've been thinking about the title of our conference. And if you weren't here for the first, the whole thing, it comes down to this. How can we redeem rhetoric to serve God's, his redemptive purpose, which he speaks in person in Jesus Christ and through the words, many and varied in Scripture, but also in drafting people, humble people like you and me, who do not have the answer in ourselves. We have the answer, capital T, capital A, in the person and work of God, the Son, Jesus Christ, the Word, the light who shines in the darkness, and darkness cannot prevail against it. In our times, speaking a faithful word to our Lord is getting, I will not say harder. The choices that we have to make, fundamental allegiances that we have to make and decide that we believe and are going to so act and so advocate, the three crucial movements of rhetoric. The times are getting not better, 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 more and more urgent. The issues of which we have to declare our fundamental allegiance are becoming clearer and clearer. There's a true either-or that sums up the kairos of our moment. Nihilism or theism. The tension between these two worldviews is pulling at the heartstrings of every single person in this room and in the heartstrings of your students, their families, and in the wider world into which we hope to send them. That's the whole vision of the first talk. Many of you came up afterwards and you asked, how do we take that vision and start to do practical things with it? So this is going to be a talk about tools and practices. So if you look at your outline, the first, and I'll get to the illustrations, the separate handout that I brought instead of slides here. The backside of the handout has a three-legged stool sitting on three three-legged stools. And your homework assignment is, at some point, you need to define for your school and your zip code in today's world, what are the core principles, what are the fundamental ideas, principles, that you want to build and refine your rhetoric program, your thesis program around. And I put the three main pillars under the banner or the stool of charity, of love, because of 1 Corinthians 13. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but have not charity, I'm just adding to the noise. And there's a lot of noise today. I propose that the most important practical principle you can pursue and your program is charity. It's the one thing. If we do not pursue charity, our rhetoric is worthless. Worse, we are adding skill and effectiveness to our students who may be in thrall to unethical and possibly demonic projects. That's a bold claim. Okay. I know it is, and I need to be careful that I not overstate it. But I think that's true. We need to be careful how we teach rhetoric. I think it's a fascinating Harkness discussion. Sorry, Socratic roundtable discussion for you to propose to your students on the first day of class whether or not it's a good idea to teach rhetoric. Do you see why I think that's a good question? I don't assume it's a good idea. It's far better to have a good person who speaks poorly than a bad person who speaks well. Grounds for that claim? History. Just the way it is. If you want a more specific ground, Paul, 1 Corinthians 13. It's the first point he makes. I will show you a more excellent way. What's excellent? The highest peak on the mountain that we're all trying to climb up? What is it? Knowledge? Power? Pascal said, knowledge and power are great, and there is super abundant pearls of wisdom and knowledge and achievement and power, okay? And they belong to different orders. A general cannot, through force, learn geometry. Alexander was reputed to have commanded a math teacher, teach me geometry overnight. And the math teacher said to him, sire, there's no royal road to learning. You can't force knowledge. You have to learn it. It belongs to a different order, Pascal said. It's a higher order. This is why intellectuals, frankly, get irritated by a lot of people who belong to the order of force, the order of the body, that which guts and muscle and money can win. Higher than both, there's only one person in history who belonged to that order. Jesus. Abounding neither in force nor in wisdom. Thrice holy to God. He was super eminent in charity, in love. I think that's a very practical idea. Helmut Tillich, the 20th century Lutheran theologian, said, there's nothing more practical than a good idea. I like that. I like ideas. I struggle with practical, so this is about practice, and we need to talk about how to make this stuff practical. So how do you make it practical? The fundamental value for working with parents is trust, open communication, and ongoing learning. Trust, open communication, and ongoing learning. At the beginning of the school year, we had a cocky high school boy who wanted to argue the merits of public breastfeeding without a shawl. You can imagine that this irritated and offended some of the female staff, irritated our administration. I had full permission to shut the kid down. Met with the parents, met in council with my friend Pete, and both parents came in. Dad's a high-powered lawyer. Stakes were high. And they assured me that this kid was going to argue the case ethically, that he had a good case to be made. And I was prepared to shut it down. The mom, at halfway through the meeting, well over an hour, and she looked at me in the eyes and she said, I know my son. And I know that he's not going to betray me or this school or your expectations for him. We let him argue the case. We also pressured him to change his argument, to argue the merits of breastfeeding, period, and then look at some of the institutional challenges that women face, modern workforce, et cetera, et cetera. And he changed his claim, and he got a solid A. One of my students' better theses. And he did it with integrity. So we need to be willing to listen and learn and trust our parents. Next point, healthy partnerships, delegating key tasks. I think healthy partnerships, and I'm sorry, my outline's not going to match my three-legged stool, but I think that's what sums up the, Healthy partnerships are that's the key idea of working with faculty and staff. We have at Regents, students pick their topics in the fall. They research them in the fall. The main goal is for them to learn the library and internet research skills and get acquainted with their topics, formulate a hypothetical claim that they will defend in the body and in the recitatio of their thesis. Sorry, that's the answering challenges. And they set that up in December over the Christmas break, and then they come back to work in the spring, and they flesh out the three key confirming points of evidence and data to back up those three confirming points. And they end up building something like this. It's a three-legged stool sitting on top of three three-legged stools. Their main claim sits on top. The three main arguments are A, B, and C. And the three platforms of supporting data are under each of the three-legged stools. Very, very nice aesthetic. Very architecturally pleasing. Kind of looks like a Greek column, right? Yeah, nice and it's stable. It's not easily knocked over. In that process, we partner with fellow faculty. We want the faculty to push back and to show kids that they don't know everything that they think they do. So they will meet with students in the spring, and they'll push back. They'll show them that they need to consider other elements, other evidence sources, and other perspectives. So it's an ongoing refining process. So they so we need to be in healthy, open, trusting communication with our faculty, and we need to define for them what their role is. What we did this year to change a little bit is in the past, those faculty advisors, our colleagues who are helping walk through the thesis process, research, and forming claim, we asked them to dial back their involvement a little bit in the content, to trust the main teachers, me, to trust us to help the students develop their claim, and then to ask really good questions, and to they also form one of the members of the four-panel judge committee that are thesis students have to face. They present in front of the community, in front of four judges for 20 minutes, and then have to answer 20 minutes of question. This is all public. They're there to be a warm and friendly face, to encourage that student who's very nervous, who has to do something like this for the first time in their life, and it's intimidating. They have to do that. And so what we want to do is define, here's the takeaway point, define a clear role for how your faculty can help you get that student on solid ground with a solid structure. But don't overwhelm them, and definitely encourage your fellow faculty to not do a hypothetical thesis through that student. I have done that. It does not help the student, and it does not help the faculty. So I'm speaking from personal experience when I say that. Healthy partnerships, not codependent, nor isolated. We don't want our fellows faculty to not feel like they're part of the thesis project. So this year, another change that we instituted, we're still learning at Regents. We've been doing thesis for a long time, but we had drifted in a direction where the faculty advisors thought that they needed to pick the thesis topics that they were interested in or that they had expertise in. That's not what the faculty role is about. That's not a healthy way of thinking about partnering to help students. So this year we asked kindergarten teachers all the way up through 12. We asked maintenance staff, janitors, and maintenance staff to join in the advising process. And we had, we asked the school nurse, janitors, school nurses, coaches always are available to be faculty advisors. Healthy partnership. We want the thesis project to reflect something of the ethos of the school that we, our school community. What's it like to shepherd and disciple students in the context of learning whatever academic discipline they're learning? Shifting C after delegating key tasks. Now I'll make one point there. Community, the wider community of parents and friends who are in the Regents community serve as thesis judges, and there's a whole crew of people who volunteer to be judges, and they'll judge multiple topics. That team of people, thesis judges, is led up by a woman who's been doing it for several years, and then she works hard to keep those judges on schedule, to keep them coming in. And so delegating key tasks, think about that as you don't have to do everything as the thesis teacher or the thesis program director. You can ask for help, and you can do so with a vision. You can be fed by a vision of caritas, of charity, right, that we're sharing in this work together to get our kids prepared to witness, and that our janitors have something valuable to contribute, as well as the broader public of friends and family who want to serve as thesis. So each part has to come together. Other key tasks, I mean, this concept of delegating key tasks is as simple as who fills the punch bowl and fills the cookie trays in the reception room for the judges when they finish and they go back. We have a team of moms who do that. And there's a lead mom who shepherds and mentors her successor for the following year. And so she's even delegating tasks to her successor so that we have... this year it was amazing. The food was great. Patty Sadler, what a great woman. Her son Grant is a junior, and she's shepherding her successor, who will take over her role next year. And she's mentoring her to show her how to do that. Something as simple as just managing snacks, managing signs to direct guests, grandparents who come to hear the theses. Our audio and visual or computer science, our IT people, they also have a key role because we do live streaming. We use the ability to use to film on the internet so that friends and family who are not present can watch. The pieces of the program that come together in order to make the thesis show happen, it's overwhelming. It's a team of so many people with different roles, and they're all coming together to hold up and support and love our kids and hopefully get them through their thesis, arguing something that is worthwhile. So let's shift to the students, walking through the year with students. And I'm sorry, but my points I'm going to combine here. So I'm going to speak about C in the middle of the page of 54, and then Roman numeral 2 under the same heading. Really, walking through the year together is working with our students well. And how do we do that? What we want them to do, we want them to personally espouse and love and buy into a Christian worldview. And we want them to apply that to their thesis topic. That was the point of my first talk. Okay. Careful. We are not the Holy Spirit. And we cannot demand that our students choose a topic and advocate a position that we approve of, because it's not about our approval. If they argue a position that does not conform to a Christian worldview in our judgment, we do let that student pursue that topic and that judgment in that case. And we promise them that they will face the full barrage of everything we've got to counter, to dig in and dig under their fundamental assumption, to challenge their worldview, and to challenge their position, and to challenge whether or not they know enough of everything that they should know in order to argue their position. And we find that that tension is especially fruitful. Why do we do that? George Marsden recently wrote a very useful article called Towards a More Inclusive Pluralism in the February edition of First Things. I'm going to hold it up to put a peg in your memory. It's George Marsden. It's the last chapter, I think, of his book, Twilight of the American Enlightenment, which recently came out. He's advocating a more inclusive pluralism. It's really important for you to distinguish the term principled pluralism, which he argues on Christian, Augustinian, Abraham Kuyperian, Reformed theological grounds. Theological and philosophical. That's a tradition. Augustine through Kuyper is a tradition of theology and philosophy. On those grounds, he argues that we need to let students disagree with us. Kuyper argued that we need a civic government, or in his context, the Netherlands of the late 19th century, we need a civic principle that allows free, open, worldviewish discussion to take place, because that's what dialogue, in fact, is. We hear a lot about dialogue, and a lot of times what people mean by dialogue is, I'll talk to you as long as you agree with my core assumption. That's what they mean. They don't say it. Okay. And oftentimes, I'll talk to you as long as you agree with my core assumption is coming from the mouth of a really, really conservative person, or a really, really liberal person. Do you see the worldview issue? The fundamental principle and approach that you take to any topic already sets you going down a certain way. We need to relax, back up, recognize that Jesus Christ is the way, the truth, the life, capital T, the capital T truth, W. We need to relax and follow him and let the issues sort themselves out. That's the heartbeat. Marsden claims that's the heartbeat of the Augustinian vision, and that's the heartbeat of Kuyper's application of that in the Netherlands. By the way, Kuyper, not an unaccomplished man, started a newspaper, started a university, the Free University of Amsterdam, wrote volumes of systematic theology, pastored churches, and was was the prime minister of the Netherlands. That's five things, okay, that are really impressive. Okay, that's Abraham Kuyper. Kuyper. George, if you do nothing else this conference, read this article. You can buy it for $1.99 on firstthings.com, ft.com. It, far better than I could ever hope to do, casts a vision for the heartbeat of the tone, the tonality, the way in which we want to cut a middle path between postmodern relativism and dogmatic and closed-minded conservatism. How do you do that? How do you take Augustine's confession, the insight that all reasoning, whether you're a Christian or not, whether you believe in God or whether you're an atheist, that you do your reasoning with the tools of reasoning from a prior fundamental faith commitment. That's the meaning of fides quadam intellectum. It did not apply to believers only, according to Augustine. B.B. Warfield taught the point in the Princeton Review that Augustine made that point about everybody. And that is a true observation of human nature. It is confirmed in science and in math by developments in the 20th century. It's true of every single topic that our students choose and the way they choose to develop it and ground their claims. How do you get that idea, that Augustinian, Kuiperian idea that Marsden advocates, how do you get students to use a tool to navigate all the vexing issues of researching evidence, forming a hypothetical claim to defend, actually defending it, and then answering it against countercharges? Where am I in my outline? Helping students refine topics. I'm talking about, on the next page, if you look at A, B, and C, I'm really talking about all three of these at the same time. So if it sounds like going back to square one, that's the faith-seeking understanding, the Augustinian fides quaeris intellectum. I can't believe she took that position. I think that speaks for itself. Helping students refine their topics. Now I'm going to give you two word pictures. These are really useful pictures to help students understand and make progress to refine their topic and their claim that they're going to make about their topic. Let's say that the topic is, I'm going to pick a juicy one at this conference, okay? I'm not going to hold back, but it is observed by in the display room downstairs, we have contending visions, contending convictions of how to reconcile science and faith. Both parties believe in God. Both parties love God and believe that God created the world and sent his Son to redeem us. If you checklist the Apostles' Creed, every single article, I would be willing to bet that both parties sincerely and with goodwill affirm those positions. They differ radically in how they understand what God created the world means, in terms of how that played out. Safe to say that we have a topic here? Could someone do a research, a thesis about this topic? We had that very topic come up this year from two of my students who were in the same room, same class, Nathan and Cal. Cal's the young earth creationist. Nathan is the theistic evolutionist. Both of them come in the beginning of the year and they are dyed in the wool. They are convinced that they're right. They are dogmatically certain that they're right. And when Cal gave his closing comments, he delivered his thesis. By the way, both of them delivered fantastic theses. Cal said, I've had an iron sharpening iron experience this year with my good friend Nathan. We put each person in each other's shoes. Literally, one day, Nathan took off his cowboy boots. Cal took off his fairy shoes, and they literally put themselves into each other's shoes. Okay, so they started at that point, and they ended with the same basic thing. Cal's still young earth creationist and Nathan's still theistic evolutionist. But before both of them went, I met with both of them around a table and we prayed. And the prayer was that our community would see a living witness of charity over all. Charity over knowledge. Charity over power. Charity over all things. Charity is more important than being right. Because Paul says, if you read Paul carefully in 1 Corinthians 13, Paul is not being dogmatically passionate about a particular human construal of the truth. He is passionately arguing that love is the supreme thing. we need to let that principle guide the very way that our students walk through and refine a thesis project. How do we do that? The Toulmin model that you have, see outlined there, I don't know how many of you are familiar with Stephen Toulmin's work. He wrote this book, The Uses of Argument, in the 1950s. The main claim of this book is that we need to replace inductive, deductive logic. We need to replace Aristotelian deductive logic that has set the terms of the field of how we think about logic with a case logic model that he outlines in this book, and which is on the bottom of that page, shows you what that model looks like. He does not claim that we need to then throw away deductive and inductive logic. He says we need to displace it, set it to the side, not make it the defining definition of logic. A better model is what he calls a case logic model, where all contendants, I'm going to go back to the issue of the age of the earth and that whole dispute. All contenders on this have come at this issue, come at the scriptures, come at the evidence, come at the truth claims that they wish to advocate and advance, with a set of prior commitments, set of presuppositions, a worldview, set of convictions that shape the very terms in which they do the understanding. And they contend. Neither one of them is 100% certain. Okay? What are the things that we can be 100% certain of? Okay? In terms of like evidential reasoning, right? Mathematics, the laws of non-contradiction. But as soon as you fill up the syllogisms of logic with content, now we get into a debate, don't we? Right? How good are the grounds on which you build up the evidence to argue your case? How good are the grounds of evidence is a disputed question. The very evidence itself is approached with differing convictions about what constitutes good evidence. I'm not a relativist. This isn't relativism, but neither is it dogmatism. The Toulmin model gives you not the truth, capital T, it gives you a useful tool to seek truth. And remember, since we're talking about Augustine, how did he open the Confessions? You have made us for yourself, O Lord, and our hearts are incomplete. They're incomplete, and they're hungry until they feed on you, God, for you alone are the fullness that our hearts seek. Something to that effect. Our hearts are restless until they rest in God. Being right, according to whatever our tradition has told us on that particular issue, that's not ultimate. Far more ultimate than that is the issue of nihilism versus theism. And that is a conflict of worldview that we see raging in the hearts of everyone in this room, in the pop culture, in the hearts of professors, in the hearts of janitors. There's a book called The Sunset Limit that our seniors graduate reading. This is the final book that they read, by Cormac McCarthy. It's a dialogue between a suicidal professor who is an atheist and a nihilist. And he's the white man whose heart is given over to the dark abyss. The black man in the movie, Samuel Jackson, is the man who hears the voice of Jesus and who persuades him, Simon Lee Jones, the white professor, to not kill himself. And the whole movie is one conversation between these two fundamentally opposed worldviews. It's called The Sunset Limited. It's a Cormac McCarthy novel. And it's fittingly the last thing that our seniors read at Regents, because they are going into a world where these two fundamental worldviews are principle against principle, fundamentally opposed. How are we going to equip them with useful tools to argue, to persuade their peers as they go off to college, and to be true advocates for that which is good, true, and beautiful? The three transcendentals, those aren't empty formal categories. What grounds those? The truth, the good, and the beauty. Do you see it? Can't you hear the postmodern voices just going, yeah, truth, goodness, and beauty? Those are just like pasted terms that you Christians use to paste over your power claims. Jesus is true, capital T. He is good, capital G. He is beautiful, capital B. There is truth, goodness, and beauty. We do not live in a postmodern myth. But I propose to you that our students are entering a world where this tension. So when you give them tooling as a tool to use to develop their topic and claim in the context of their thesis, even if they're arguing a position you don't like, I can't believe they took that position. Trust God's Spirit to lead them in the truth. He promises to do that in Scripture. He also promises that there will be a witness to him in every tongue, tribe, and nation, in every age. I think that's mysterious. Colossians has a portrait of Christ in chapter 1. Christ is he who made the world, he who redeems it, and he who finishes it. He is explicitly named as the mystery who is now revealed. Capital M mystery. Like a bubble that you blow out of a little soap thing, I'd like to launch a little idea out here. If you can pop it, this is like a little bubble. My model is not the answer. It's a word picture to help our students imagine what their fundamental situation is vis-a-vis their topic and the claim they wish to. They do so already enveloped in one kind of a mythos or other. So notice the three appeals that Aristotle outlines. There is logos, ethos, and pathos. Unlike Aristotle, well, this is a technical debate. I actually think Aristotle sees those much more deeply integrated and not textbook chapter isolatable, siloed. He actually sees those as much more integrated. If you want to research that, read an article by James Murphy called The Meta Rhetoric of Aristotle. He argues it far better than I could. That aside, so I actually think this is, I actually would claim this is a better representation of Aristotle on the grounds of James Murphy's study and reading of Aristotle's treatise on rhetoric, his culminating final life's work, which he never finished. This paradigm shows, though, the point I'm making through Augustinian lenses and Kuyperian lenses. Even our reasoning and our ethical paradigm and our passions, that which gets us at our gut, that which gets us at our chest, and that which gets us in our head. The head, the hands, and the heart are linked and surrounded in a myth. And there are only two myths. There aren't only two myths. There are lots of myths. But there are only two myths that really matter. C.S. Lewis. Jesus Christ, the what? True myth, whose beauty and goodness and truth are reflected in all the best myths, Greek and non, throughout all ages. That's why we read. Dr. Louis Marcus makes precisely that claim on Christian ground, we read classical myths because they do indirectly relate. They get us at our guts. They get us at our hearts. They move our hearts and our minds and our imaginations. Our minds, our hearts, and our imaginations are deeply and intimately connected. Do you know the brain science right now shows there's a claim by a doctor who is a cardiologist who says the heart cannot be mechanically reproduced. Do you know why? It's so complicated that our very cognition, they can show this medically now. They have the technology to show that electrical impulses from the heart are connected to cognition. What you care about affects what you believe to be true. They are not isolatable. What is the myth? What's the surrounding environment in which that head-heart connection, head-heart-chest, what you believe to be true, what you know is good and right, and what you feel in your guts is right, they are deeply connected, and they happen inside stories. The difference, and this is where this model actually fails, it's not an empty formal category into which Christianity is inserted and competes against others, and we're all just dancing around an endless table. Here's the table, and what's the truth? And this postmodern lie? No. He's the truth. But if I force my student to agree with me, and I don't trust the process of them working through it on their own, I'm actually trying to do what only the Holy Spirit can do. And I'm not allowed to do that. Paul didn't do that. Study Paul. Study his address to the Athenians, most sophisticated or articulate people in the world at that time in Acts chapter 17. How many people converted at the hearing of Paul's message? A lot of people. At most, there were just a couple people who were stirred up and said, "Oh, we'll hear you again." You know. Actually, Luke, in writing Acts, is kind of skeptical, but they wanted to hear him again. He also said that the people who gather at the marketplace, they just love to hear the latest idea. Just more and more of the same. Just multiplying words. Words without meaning. When I'm arguing, please hear me, I am not arguing for relativism. There is a relative aspect to all partial, limited, human, frail, broken, sinful attempts to grasp truth. Who in this room would claim to have a full grasp on truth? So what are we going to do? I think I'm right. You probably think I'm wrong on some point. You probably think I'm wrong on how to handle the evolution thing. You know what? None of us is right, capital R. Where's the charity? Where's the love? Where's the process and the tool to help our kids navigate it? Those boys prayed together before they gave their talks. Each one of them got up in front of our audience and delivered a very, I'm proud of those boys. They did as well. They did as right. They showed our community this issue will not divide regions. Shouldn't divide us here. If I love you, I love my wife. I love my boys. I trust them. Even if they disagree with me, I would not be standing here a married man wearing this band if I didn't fundamentally believe that. Inside my band is written a passage from 1 Peter. You will go through the trial of fire. Just like this gold. Do you know the passage I'm talking about? If you go through the trial of fire that gold has to go through, you damn well better be sure that you're not 100% correct all the time. better be ready for some refining. Nothing like marriage, nothing like parenting has taught me that. So let's pretend like the issue is not me in front of the stage being all wise and doing my polished senior thesis. Let's pretend the issue under debate is who's right in a debate with my wife. This model helps marriage. Okay? I'm not talking, this is not textbook chapter 1, then chapter 2, then chapter 3, then chapter 4. Right? Check, check, check. Walking in a line and now I'm done. Now I'm the expert. We don't want our kids to think like that. This picture model, and please push back. If you can picture this better than I did in this, I would love to see it. I want a better model. I'm happy if you pop my bubble. It's the best I can do to reduce to a basic image what I think is the fundamental situation, and here's the limit of the model. It's not moving. It's not moving. It has to be living. My judgment of what's good, true, and beautiful, logos, ethos, pathos, does not happen as an isolated individual. It happens in a community. It happens in a pattern of embodied social living. James Davison Hunter wrote To Change the World. James K. Smith, wrote something about the kingdom. Do you know the book I'm talking about? Desiring the Kingdom. I'm just trying to sell those guys' books. Okay? That's all I'm trying to do. Read James Davidson Hunter. Read George Marsden. Okay? Read Stephen Toulmin. Because you know what you're going to end up doing if you do so? You can go back and read Augustine. And you're going to realize capital P philosophy doesn't exist. Anthony Gottlieb concluded that in his magnum opus, The History of Reason. Set out to write the definitive history of reason in Western philosophy and concluded that philosophy doesn't exist. Capital P. What does exist? People like you and me in God's one world that He made, that He's redeeming right now through institutions. Hunter's book is great because he says we do what we do in the service of God's calling and kingdom. We have to do it. We have to build an institution. And in order to build an institution, we have to do that with other people, and we have to do it with good principles. The tools I'm giving you with Toulmin and Hunter and Marsden, the way that they apply this case-style reasoning to public issues is the heartbeat of what we're trying to do at Reasons. If I were to pinpoint a book that articulates the heart, well, I'd do three. I'd do 1 Corinthians chapter 13. So in order of descending importance, 1 Corinthians 13 first, Augustine's Confession second, Abraham Kuyper's Lectures on Calvinism third, toss-up between George Marsden's Twilight of the American Enlightenment and James Davidson Hunter for contemporary articulations of this vision. If you want a more secular perspective, but the logic overlaps significantly, Stephen Toulmin's Uses of Argument. I'm making a bold claim about this, but I have C.S. Lewis as my backing. Study C.S. Lewis's apologetic style. He uses a cumulative case model of reasoning. He's not opposed to deductive and inductive logic. He studies it. He uses it. He uses it far better than I can. I'm a hopeless poser compared to C.S. Lewis. The thing that has always struck me about C.S. Lewis's way of using logic, if you read his essays, is how quick he is to illustrate his point with metaphors. He's a master poet. as well as a logician. Why? Have you ever just, like, why is he able to do that? It's the bubble in which he said this. I believe in God, not because I can see him with my mind's eye. Because without God, I can't see anything. But with him, I see everything. It's a beautiful picture. That's what I'm trying to, it's the word picture that I'm trying to, through a very reduced geometrical model with the bubble there, that's what I'm trying to picture there. Through God, I see everything. Okay? Now, ultimately, and I said this in the first text, the only true source of truth, true truth, as Francis Schaeffer called it, what's that source? You know. It's the Sunday school answer. It really is, though. People scoff. Oh, it's the Sunday school answer. Shut up. Okay? Shut up. That is the answer. That Sunday school answer is the heartbeat of Augustine's confession. He started a Christian. Did you know that? His mom was a Christian and prayed for him his whole life. He never wasn't a Christian. He flirted with, was seduced by, and had a Manichaean love affair. He had other love affairs. Okay? Like the real ones. And then he converted to philosophy through Cicero. And then, as Augustine tells in the confession, it was Paul's message in Romans that we're saved by grace that converted him. So there you have it. A Christian who was converted to Christ. It's the bubble, folks. That's what I'm getting at. Okay? And unless you are, as Paul said in Colossians chapter 1, unless you are lifted out by that true one and placed into a new bubble, transferred from the kingdom of darkness and brought into and ported into the kingdom of light, you are the slave of your untoward passions, your crooked judgments of what's good, and your perverse and misguided judgments of what's true. Because you're under the dominion of the leader and the ruler of this world. Folks, I asked my dear friend Pete. By the way, last night I was terrified of giving these talks. He encouraged me so much. And I said, Pete, is it true that there is such a thing as a true dilemma? A true either or? And he said, I don't know. He's hard to persuade. Okay. Why? What are you thinking? Because I think there might actually be a true dilemma. What if it's true that there's a true dilemma? And what if that true dilemma, the either or, is the thing that's pulling on all of our hearts in two directions? Then what? If it's true. And then what if you grant this, that, and this is my hypothesis. So you all please disagree with me if you don't agree. If you don't agree, push back. I would love to hear your thoughts. That the true dilemma that's tugging at the heart of each and every person in this room, in this conference, and outside these walls, is a core conviction of nihilism and a core conviction of theism, God, or nothing. And each one of us has to choose which of these core principles we're going to live our life by. And our students have to choose that. And I think they need to hear it from the rhetoric teachers. Okay, that's my whole point. I'm going back to the first talk. I'm supposed to be talking about practical tools. Here's the reality. I can't tell you in this setting right here all the details of how to flesh this out into a working program. I can have that conversation, and I would love to, but I can't do it here. Your circumstances are too different. Some of you came up after the last talk, and you said, we're just starting our rhetoric program. We're nowhere near where you are at Regents. At Regents, we're streaming these things live. Our debate at Regents is whether or not to have a vinyl sign on the curtains behind the podium that was just custom made. Okay? That's just such a different setting and different set of concerns. Okay? Frankly, I think y'all are in a much more exciting place to pioneer and lay the groundwork. Because I believe in James Davidson Hunter's vision. Where'd my book go? Can't make a point. This guy says, you people who are pioneering new programs, or whose programs are at the crisis point and it needs a facelift, it needs a fundamental DNA transfer, blood transfusion, you need to do a facelift and redesign, rethink the whole thing. You are at the front edge of the real cultural battle. Regents has a different problem. We, now that we've built our program, we need to make sure that we maintain it and hold it true to the school vision. What's the school vision? The school mission? To produce kids, if we can, with God's help. With God's help. Okay? Nothing else will do. Have kids come out of that school loving what's good, true, and beautiful, practicing it, serving others, and doing so from a Christian worldview. I would love to hear the diverse questions, pushback, challenges, counterclaims any of you have. We're going to set up in our tent all week for all conference. I'll be there as much as I can. I sent around a sign-up sheet last session. If you didn't sign your email, if you could just do me a favor, and if you want to send me an email, tell me I'm an idiot or whatever, just sign this. Or maybe I'll. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to set this up over at the door for when you leave. You have been a very kind audience. So if you have any questions, I'd love to spend whatever time. How much time do we have left? Done. Sorry. No time for questions. But we'll be hanging out at the booth. Thank you. Yes, thank
you. Glad to see you this week.
Great.
I'll talk to you about the basic question myself.
Excellent.
I'm on my third group.